Justice and Drew, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. My name is actually Walter Hudson. Brian McDaniel in studio with me this morning.
My name actually is John Justice, but it was confusing, so I changed it to Brian McDaniel.
That was a solid legal and permanent move on your part.
Yes.
Quite the commitment to the program this morning. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. Breanne producing the show for us this morning. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. Two ways to stream the program.
I was going to say, and happy President's Day.
Oh, and yes, of course. Lest we not forget.
So, Zachary Taylor.
Yes.
Enjoy your day.
We're just going down the list of presidents. We're going to get through all of them over the course.
James A. Garfield, today's your day, and you'll get another day later in the year.
Yes.
Look it up, kids.
The true meaning of President's Day, lest we not forget. All right, we've been talking about the shooting in Florida and the predictable, but yeah. Yes, we're having the same old gun control debate that we always have in the wake of these incidents, but there's a different flavor to this one.
Yeah.
And I haven't quite put my finger on exactly what it is that makes it different, but it feels as though, you know, perhaps it's the resistance, right? Perhaps it's the whole Trump thing, the anti-Trump thing of being ready to pounce with a campaign that's direct. And perhaps it's the midterm elections, the fact that it's 2018, we're headed right into an election season. And so there's this machine that's geared up and ready to go to try to capitalize on any issue that presents itself. But very quickly, we've gone, and by quickly, I mean within a matter of hours, we went from mourning a tragedy to facing a well-oiled political machine that had co-opted students from this school in order to promote the notion that you're either for gun control and against the NRA, or you want to see students die brutal deaths. Like, those are the two camps.
Those people don't want to see students die. They're just okay with it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, they're complicit. The language that's been used is you're complicit. You have blood on your hands.
Yeah.
You know, you're as responsible as the guy who shot. Give me a break, okay? Like, this is utter and complete nonsense. The idea that you're going to, that something happening to you gives you the moral right to condemn me when I had nothing, literally nothing to do with it.
Well, and there is a common ground here that if we were a healthier nation, I think that we could have banded together and rallied around. And that was the failure.
Correct.
Of our existing law enforcement and mental health institutions to protect these kids in Parkland.
And indeed, attached to that, there may in fact be some tweaking of gun laws related to how we deal with people who have issues, who have diagnosed issues, or who are suspect with good cause. You know, perhaps there is a process we could look at to restrict guns in very specific circumstances. But in order to have that actual conversation, that actual good faith discussion, it has to start from the premise of, let's figure out what the problem is and identify a solution. Mm-hmm. But that's not the premise that we're operating under. No. The premise that we're operating under is, let's have a political campaign geared against the NRA and against Republicans.
Well, and the against Republicans part is what I'm going to talk about right now. Not that there aren't, you know, in Congress and in the Senate and whatnot, not that there aren't more Republicans that kind of support the Second Amendment and gun rights than Democrats. Yes, that is probably true. By percentage, it probably is more of a Republican position. However, supporting the Second Amendment is not purely a Republican view. I mean, we have evidence of it right here in Minnesota,
right,
where your presumptive DFL gubernatorial candidate, Tim Walz, has an A rating from the NRA.
Right.
He has been a very proud supporter in rural Minnesota.
I'm sure his campaign appreciates you mentioning that.
Yeah. Well, but it's true because there have been times very recently in the state of Minnesota where the House, the Senate, and the governor were all controlled by Democrats. Mm-hmm. What major gun legislation was passed
Correct.
Then? And there have been times very recently in on the federal level in D.C. where the House, Senate, and president, the executive branch, have been controlled by Democrats. What were the major, you know, guns that were taken off the street then? Mm-hmm. And that is not an argument for how strong the NRA is. Mm-hmm. In Minnesota, I can tell you they are not, that organization does not come in here with money. They don't come in here with people who are walking the halls of the Capitol. I'm there every day. Mm-hmm. Every once in a while, somebody will fly in from DC for a specific hearing or something like that. This is something that is a grassroots issue. It is much more than Republican Democrat. It's probably almost more rural metro how a lot of the views on this go. So this is not something that is purely a Republican problem. Republicans are in control of most things right now, so it is falling upon them. But when the roles were reversed, major things did not happen.
651-989-5855 is the number to join us. Let's talk with Pete. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Every time that I hear somebody say we need to pass common sense gun laws, I cringe inside, and here's why. I work in law enforcement, and from personal experience, what I've seen is there's a massive failure. And I would encourage anybody whose position it is that we need to pass additional laws or common sense gun laws, as the buzzword or whatever, I want you to go to your county. I want you to look up the conviction rate of violent crimes with guns, and then I want you to look at the sentencing. And, oh, there's mandatory sentencing guidelines. Yes, there are, and here's what happens. It's very frequently, so frequently you would be ill. The judge sentences. The judge stays within the mandatory guidelines and then stays the entire sentence. I'm talking about robbery with a firearm in which there are witnesses, the gun is recovered, prints and DNA. There's a conviction, 6 years conviction to St. Cloud. The entire sentence is stayed. And it happens so frequently that we can't, to ignore this would be irresponsible at best.
So what is the rationalization that's offered for staying a sentence in those circumstances?
I don't know, because that is not something that a judge is required to provide. And I don't know what the political position of these judges is. I don't know what the rationale is. And it wouldn't be in the paperwork. That would be something that the citizenry would have to demand accountability of, that either appointed or elected judge. That would have to be done in their office, and even then they're not required. But there's zero repercussion and zero accountability for judges,
right,
except in the election process, for anything that they issue from the bench. And when these people go out, and they do, the recidivism is very high. They go out, and within that period of time which they would have been incarcerated, commit multiple more violent crimes with firearms. I look at it, and to me it's enraging.
Understandably. That's what we call righteous indignation. I appreciate your call, Pete. Yeah, that evokes an issue that I recall from my time in the Tea Party movement back in the day. One of the big issues that rose to prominence, at least here in Minnesota, was the notion of judicial accountability and reform, and the idea that, you know, our judges are appointed, they do not face election. And I don't know where I stand on that. I don't know how great it would be to have political elections and campaign ads running for judges and what have you. That might have a tainting process on justice. At the same time, there is an insulation between judges and the real world.
Well, because, you know, in Minnesota, most of them get appointed and then they stand for re-election, but there's no information that's available on them. So people are voting not knowing.
Right.
I remember when I was more of a practicing attorney, you know, my job is more political now, but when I was a practicing attorney, even I, as a practicing attorney, when I would vote, would not know very much about most of the judges if I hadn't stood before them in court, which was almost none of them.
Well, and part of the reason for that is that, and this is me working from memory, but I believe it actually is illegal to campaign for a judicial office. That was one of the things that the candidates for who were challenging incumbent judges back in the time when I was active on that issue were complaining about, was that their capacity to actually campaign for the job was very limited. You know, they could go out in there and say, hey, I'm a good guy, here's my name, I'm qualified, but they couldn't get into the particulars of what sort of principles they would bring to the table, how they would rule on particular topics and what have you. Let's go to Dave from Santiago. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Excuse me. here are a few things I want to bounce off you. Number one, remember years ago, Alan Page, he sued to be able to be voted in office or voted in as a judge. And then later, once he was in, no, you can't do anything to get me out. Number two, why don't you look at one of the high school sports that is the fastest and biggest growing in the state, and that is the high school trap shooting league, okay? And when spring comes and they've got the annual event in Alexandria, they've got upwards of 13,000 kids competing,
okay?
No accidents, no problems. And the third thing I want to bring up is, if you look back at history, martial arts were started because weapons were taken away from these peasants. And many of the instruments that were turned into fighting weapons, like you see nunchucks and such, were used for ricing and other farming equipment. Okay. When people are stripped of their rights to use a firearm or any other weapon, they will come up with other means, and you'll look at the number of knifings that have increased in areas where they've taken away firearms from other individuals.
Well, and Dave brings a good point, too, is that right now, you know, we couldn't have less faith in our political institutions. It, you know, many people would say they don't trust President Trump. They don't trust the police. However, many of those same people are saying, we trust the police, we trust President Trump, we trust the government to take our guns away.
And it's
completely, you can't equate the two things. I mean, it's boggling that, especially now, when the left is so disappointed in law enforcement, in the presidency, in government, that they would say, all right, Bo, you know what? We're trusting you to do something that gives you so much power over the citizenry.
Well, and I think the way to understand that or interpret that is that it's not some sort of expression of faith in the status quo, in Donald Trump and the Republicans in control of Washington, but rather it's part of a campaign to get them out of there. This is entirely about the 2018 election cycle. You know, after that comment regarding martial arts, though, I can't get the image out of my head of using nunchucks to harvest rice, which strikes me as rather amusing. 538 has a breakdown, statistical breakdown, under the headline "Mass Shootings Are a Bad Way to Understand Gun Violence," and the, you know, their conclusion that they wrap up with here, I think, cuts to the heart of what we've been trying to say this morning. They write, "You could theoretically cut down on all these deaths with a blanket removal of guns from the U.S. entirely. Something that is as politically unlikely as it is legally untenable. Barring that, though, policies aimed at reducing gun deaths will likely need to be targeted at the specific people who commit or are victimized by those incidents. And mass shootings just aren't a good proxy for the diversity of gun violence. Policies that reduce the number of homicides among young black men, such as programs that build trust between community members, police, and at-risk youth, and offer people a way out of crime, probably won't have the same effect on suicides among elderly white men," another form of gun violence. "Background checks and laws aimed at preventing a young white man with a history of domestic violence from obtaining a gun and using it in a mass shooting might not prevent a similar shooting by an older white male with no criminal record. If we focus on mass shootings as a means of understanding how to reduce the number of people killed by guns in this country, we're likely to implement laws that don't do what we want them to do and miss opportunities to make changes that really work. Gun violence isn't one problem, it's many, and it probably won't have a single solution either." Mm-hmm. And that, after all, is the entire point. If you really want to get at the heart of what the problem is, the problem, the first clue is that it's not a problem. It's multiple different facets of an intersection of policies, many of which are broken. I mean, go down the list of what we've talked about so far. We've talked about problems with the judicial system, with sentencing. We've talked about, you know, issues in the mental health system, failure to recognize, failure to act. We haven't even touched upon the fact that the FBI had this guy served up to them on a silver platter.
Yep.
I mean,
didn't even notify local law enforcement. Didn't even pass the buck.
This is like that scene in Airplane where the terrorists walk through the metal detector while they're frisking their grandma. I mean, yeah. It's that level of absurdity, the degree to which the alarm bells were ringing on this guy and the FBI did nothing. Nothing. That is a huge problem that ought to be addressed and won't be addressed by your favorite gun control legislation.
Nope.
It's absolutely ridiculous. Justice and Drew, my name's actually Walter Hudson. His name is actually Brian McDaniel. You can hear me on Closing Argument 9 to 11 weeknights. I'll be back on tonight, and we'll get into the guest that I'm going to have on, special guest tonight, that's relevant to one of the topics we're going to bring up here momentarily. Brian McDaniel, you can hear on Wrong About Everything, a podcast available wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. 651-989-5855, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Justice and
Justice and Drew, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. My name is Walter Hudson, normally heard 9 to 11 weeknights on Closing Argument over this very air. Got Brian McDaniel in studio as well, guest hosting with me. Appreciate you being here, Brian. Couldn't do it without you. Not this early.
That's not true, but I appreciate being here, and I appreciate you saying that.
It is true. I mean, it's you know, it's pretty early for me. I'm usually just rubbing the dirt out of my eyes at this point in the morning. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us, which you'll be able to do shortly. In the meantime, we're going to bring on our guest on the phone, Senator Carla Nelson, who has a bill in the hopper in the state legislature to address free speech on campus. And I imagine, Senator Nelson, correct me if I'm wrong, that this is either in response to or has some association with the pending appearance by Ben Shapiro at the University of Minnesota. And as a total aside, we're having Ben Shapiro on the program tonight on Closing Argument 9 to 11, so be sure to tune into that to talk about his upcoming appearance. But does that have anything whatsoever to do with this move here on your part to address free speech on campus?
Yeah, good morning, Brian. Great to be on and talk about this important thing today. Well, yes, it does, although it was an outgrowth of the bill that had been started. So this bill is really here because we know that free speech and free press are the bulwarks, really, of our country, two great bulwarks of our country. And what I found actually dated back to last fall of 2016, I had a student had told me about the incident with the bridge panels at the University of Minnesota. And just to briefly recap that, during homecoming week, each authorized student group can paint three panels on the bridge that connects the campuses. And the College Republicans painted three panels. One said College Republicans, one panel said best party on campus, very clever, and the third one said Pence, build the wall. And what happened there is really why we need this bill today. These students were not only harassed by other students and people who were, I understand, driven in. There was a lot of a defacement of the signs, but people were truly harassed, names put up on the internet, that kind of thing. But where I believe the university truly fell down was using state taxpayer resources, sending out, condemning these panels by professors at the university. So stating that they were xenophobic, homophobic, Islamophobic, racist. I mean, all these terms defining what these three panels were. And that made it very clear to me that we needed legislation that would further establish free speech on our university campuses. Our higher education institutions are not exempt from the sweep of the First Amendment's free speech rights.
So what exactly would your bill result in? What would it change? What obligations would it place upon our institutions of higher learning?
Yeah, well, the first thing it does is it our universities need to acknowledge, of course, that right for free speech. And, of course, then the teeth of the bill get to restrictions that the universities have been placing on what appears to be just a certain type of free speech. And that gets to your first question, which was the Ben Shapiro event. And the students wanted to have a large venue on campus, and the university said, well, no, we don't have a venue that large on campus that's secure, and so we're going to exile you over to the St. Paul campus, fewer students, harder to get to, and in a very much smaller venue. And then that was the second part of the bill that we amended into here as well. So, it all goes to the same thing. Anytime the universities, certainly they have to maintain their missions, and I understand rules and regs needed to maintain their mission. However, anytime that they place restrictions on free speech, either in like the bridge panels or in the Ben Shapiro upcoming event, they must be constitutional time, place, and manner restrictions. So they cannot be, well, we have room for Hillary Clinton to speak on campus at the university, and we can find a secure place for that, or for Al Franken, as happened at the University of Minnesota, but we can't find that same venue secure for a large audience for a conservative speaker. So, one, they need to recognize that any restrictions have to be constitutional when it comes to time, place, or manner. And then secondly, when it gets to that needs to be a policy, and also then the institutions need to make sure all faculty, obviously we want faculty to have free speech and discuss subjects within their area of competence and their expertise in the classroom, bringing in those additional viewpoints, which have nothing to do with their expertise or their syllabus or their course, in condemning certain free speech, should not be allowed. And then, of course, there's teeth. You know, if these policies are broken, then there's, of course of action in a court.
Now, Senator Nelson, what would you say to the detractors of this bill who say that what this bill does essentially limits their free speech, you know, the professors and whatnot?
Yes, quite frankly, there was somebody had brought that up, but actually, it does not limit professors' free speech. Obviously, they are protected by the First Amendment as well, and they can say anything that they would like. It's just in the context of the classroom where they are the authority figure speaking about. They are in that classroom teaching because they are an expert and speaking on a particular teaching and a particular topic. And of course, there is free speech to allow for that. This is just dealing with those personal viewpoints that are not related at all to the subject matter at hand or their level or their area of expertise.
So am I understanding correctly that if, like, for instance, you brought up the panels over the bridge at the University of Minnesota, that a professor who, you know, what I can't think of, you know, a subject that they might teach, let's say chemistry, that's obviously completely unrelated to anything political or anything having to do with politics or the Republican Party or what have you, if they were to come out and say through whatever venue that they condemn those panels and that they disagree with the student Republican group at the University of Minnesota, would they find themselves in violation of this law if it was passed?
Well, it depends on, are they using taxpayer resources to do so? Are they using the university mechanics to do so?
Right.
Are they doing that in the classroom where they are the person of authority? Yes, that would be true. But of course, they have that freedom of speech as well. It's just a matter of where, if they're doing it in the guise of being the authority on the subject matter.
Well, Senator Nelson, it's sad that a bill like this is necessary, because we all know, you know, having all gone to college, that the college is where you're supposed to have the free exchange of ideas, and you're supposed to be able to be wrong. You're supposed to be able to say something that's outrageous, and then, you know, and then talk it through. But where your bill is getting at a something that's definitely true is that it is that only some viewpoints are seeming to be tolerated. on college, and we're seeing that not only at our universities here, but across the nation, and it's a sad state of affairs. So
you're right, Brian, and there are other similar free speech bills that have needed to be introduced in other legislatures as well, because this is unfortunately a common occurrence. And you're right, campuses are the marketplace of ideas. That's actually part of their mission, is teaching students how to listen to a variety of points of view and analyze them and use logic and debate and define. And so I believe freedom of speech and divergent viewpoints is one of the requirements that campuses allow, not just because of our free speech rights, but because it's also part of their mission in developing students and their ability to debate and discuss. And we are missing that, aren't we, in our society?
Absolutely. State Senator Carla Nelson has been on the line with us. Appreciate you joining the program this morning. Have a good day.
Thanks, Brian.
Justice Andrew, Brian McDaniel, my name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Justice in.
I don't have anything cool enough to say over this bed.
Oh, I do.
That's Brian McDaniel. My name is Walter Hudson. We're sitting in for Justice Andrew this morning, Twin Cities News Talk. AM 1130, 103.5 FM. You can catch us streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. Show runs from 6 a.m. to 9 a.m.
Do you know where we are, Walter?
Where are we?
We're in the danger zone.
The danger zone.
Danger zone. Danger zone.
That's Breanne producing the program. All right. So, you know, I like to think of myself as intellectually kind of a jack of all trades. There aren't many topics that I don't have something of some value to contribute on.
We say that about you, as far as you know.
As far as I know, that is something that is said about me. But I will confess, one area that I have next to no knowledge on whatsoever, in fact, my knowledge is very negligible and right about at the same level as the dwarves from Snow White, is the topic of mining. I don't have a deep depth of knowledge regarding the topic of mining, but our next guest does, somebody who you are familiar with, so I will let you go ahead.
Yes. So on the line with us is Kelsey Johnson, who is the president of the Iron Mining Association of Minnesota, and her industry is seeing a little bit of a renaissance in Minnesota. It is certainly an industry that has had very tough times, is on the upswing. And a lot of what has contributed to that is their interaction with government, as far as like what regulations are being imposed, what regulations are being scaled back, and who their representation in Congress is, will have a lot to say about the next 10, 20, 50 years of iron mining in the state of Minnesota. So, Kelsey, with the retirement of Rick Nolan, who was, for all intents and purposes, a pro-mining Democrat in Congress, his retirement, surprise retirement in a lot of ways, has a great effect in your industry, doesn't it?
Yes, it really does. Thank you, Walter and Brian, for having me on. I think it's going to have a really big impact on whether or not we're actually successful long-term, like you were saying, Brian, because at the end of the day, iron mining and mining in general are a very important part of the economy in northeastern Minnesota. Not a lot of people know that we're a top five iron mining, we're a top five mining state, and we are the largest producer of iron in the U.S. So it's kind of incredible, but it's definitely something that we're very proud of and we're very excited about.
Now, one of the reasons that people say that, in addition to some family health issues that the Nolan family was experiencing, we certainly wish them the best in that. One of the things that possibly contributed to Congressman Nolan stepping down or not seeking reelection is that he was being challenged from the left by kind of someone who would call themselves an anti-mining candidate. And that was Leah Pfeiffer is her name, correct?
Yeah, Leah Pfeiffer is her name. She's from originally from like the Two Harbors area. As some of you may know, we've been mining iron for 130 years. We fully anticipate mining in northeastern Minnesota for the foreseeable future and hopefully long into the distant future. But Leah kind of came out and found the division within the Democratic Party between copper, nickel, and iron mining. And so she has been fairly vocal about her lack of support for copper, nickel projects. And I think that that's a real detriment to our overall conversation related to mining. Like I said, we've been doing it for 130 years. So I know that copper, nickel is a different type of mining, but I think that the challenge is now that with the division that's been created by the two different types. And I think it's going to be interesting to see how she plays that out, because at the end of the day, I think Iron Rangers are more interested in continuing their legacy of doing what they've done responsibly and continuing to move forward with projects as they are proposed and as they show scientific credibility and protections for the environment.
Now, what's interesting is that once Congressman Nolan said that he wasn't running again, many people on the DFL side and a few people on the Republican side have decided that they are strongly considering running or are in fact running. How many people or what are the major names on the DFL side who have declared? I know that that there is a news anchor from the Duluth area who has put her name in. Metro Joe Radinovich, who was chief of staff for the city of Minneapolis for about 15 minutes. He has now said that his name is in. But, who else might be in?
You know, we might see a number of other candidates as well. I would probably guess that we'll see at least one other entrant from the Iron Range area. We've got potential representatives and senators coming in to those two areas. And so I think we just, you know, we'll watch them closely to kind of see how that pans out. Joe and I are, we've known each other through the course of time. He was a state rep. I think that the difficulty he's going to face in his messaging is primarily around his relationship to the Metro. A lot of the folks in northern Minnesota really want their values protected and reflected, and I don't know how that's going to play out, especially with that race. So it'll be interesting to see. We've also got Michelle Lee, who's kind of come into the race as well just recently, and she too has she's actually not a fan of copper nickel mining. And would go out of her way to stop any progress on that in any way that she could. I don't know how she could at this point, but she's come out pretty strongly against copper nickel mining. And, you know, for those of us that live in northern Minnesota, we know there's a difference between the two, but very few people outside of northeastern Minnesota know that there's a difference between copper nickel mining and iron mining. So they just hear mining and generally have a positive reflection of it or not. And so it's just important that we continue to talk about the importance and the value that mining brings not only to the state but to the nation as well.
Kelsey, I'm one of those people who couldn't tell you the difference between different types of mining and has a very low institutional knowledge of how that industry works. And and I recognize I dare say that I'm humble enough to recognize that disqualifies me from having an opinion regarding whether or not people should be able to engage in mining in that area. It occurs to me, and I'd be interested to get your sense of it, being somebody who's from up there and who's familiar with the culture up there. There's all this concern about the environmental impact of mining.
Mm-hmm.
And it appears to me from the outside looking in that much of that concern is being projected from outside into a community that doesn't actually share it, or at least doesn't share it to the degree that it's being expressed more broadly.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting to hear the arguments and hear the perspectives that some folks have about this. We've had people from all over the nation that have decided to weigh in on this particular issue. We have the cleanest water in the entire state in northeastern Minnesota. Often a lot of the former iron mining sites are used as drinking water sources for some of the cities. We have some of the cleanest and best quality water, and we are doing everything on the iron mining side to protect that.
This just in, people in northeastern Minnesota do not want to poison their own water.
Yeah, weird, huh?
Yeah, weird.
Yeah, so it's a pretty strange debate. I don't know all the inner workings with the copper nickel mining, and I don't know all of the things that they're going to bring to the table. But I do think it's an important area that we need to consider, especially because we've been mining for generations in northeastern Minnesota. What better place to potentially put forward a mine than in an area that has been mining for generations and has the technology and understands the needs for good environmental regulations.
So, Kelsey, you just mentioned regulations. Some of the Obama era regulations have been walked back by the Trump administration. What effect has that had on your industry, or will it have?
Yeah, and I don't think that they've necessarily been walked back, but I think that what happened at the tail end of the Obama administration was we had a number of regulations that were starting to be imposed, or rules that were coming to fruition. And when we looked at the costs and the implications for those costs, they definitely meant that we would be taking valuable dollars away from the facilities and away from the bare necessities that we have in those facilities, and reinvestment dollars away from those facilities, putting them into regulations that may or may not do exactly what they were hoping to do. We've been doing this for a really long time, and we've got a pretty good track record, and we want to continue to grow that track record with responsible environmental regulations that are reasonable and aren't going to put us in a cost prohibitive or non-competitive situation with other countries potentially being in the fray. So with every one of these environmental regulations, there's a cost, and whether or not those costs are going to be really high and cost prohibitive for the industry is something that we have to continue to evaluate, because if it's cost prohibitive to the industry, then that means that the northern part of the state and the economy in the northern part of the state potentially can't move forward and may ultimately shut down, which is a really scary thing.
651-989-5855 is the number to join us. Mike from St. Paul has a comment he'd like to contribute to our conversation. How are you doing today, Mike?
Absolutely better than you can possibly imagine.
Wow.
Of your wildest dreams.
Your thoughts on mining up in the Iron Range?
I was born up in Hibbing, and I watched the mining decline and the jobs go away. So if there is ever one single opportunity for more expansion, as long as it is done correctly, then why would anyone in their right mind try to stop expansion from being done for more jobs and more people? I watched it collapse when I was a kid.
And
why wouldn't it be expanded now if it's done correctly?
What kind of effect did that have on the community as you were watching it happen?
I watched everything fade away in Hibbing. The little stores, the everything.
Yeah.
Sounds like the way of life.
I appreciate your comments, Mike.
Yeah.
Kelsey, you got any response to that?
Yeah, and I think that the economic downturns that we've seen over the last 130 years are different, especially lately. We had another downturn in 2015, and that was primarily due to foreign countries basically dumping their steel and iron on our shores. And I think that that raises another very important point. We're not competing necessarily with other states. We're competing with other nations. And so when you've got other nations that can pay for or subsidize energy costs or labor costs, you run into a greater consideration of what exactly are we doing to make sure that we're competitive with those other nations. And so the Trump administration's pursuing a 232 tariff that will help us basically be more cost competitive. But we need to protect our domestic iron and steel production.
Well, one thing that I think is interesting about mining jobs And, you know, I've learned this because you and I do a little bit of work together. But one of the things that I've been impressed upon is that the jobs that are being created or revived, these are good paying jobs.
Yeah, they really are. We start our folks at anywhere between 65 and 85K with full benefits. They can even be as high as six figures starting out. And that's for all different levels of the workforce. They can be engineers, and sometimes they're not engineers. That's a really good income in a very rural area with a very low cost of living. Mm. So this is something that you can't replace. And I think I got a little frustrated during 2015 when the debate was, well, folks can just move to the cities and get a job in the cities that pays that same amount. But the cost of living is different. You're moving people out of their communities and potentially taking them away from generations of history of something that they know so well. And so it's not something that you can easily fill or basically go towards. I think it's really important that we keep these jobs in the community as much as possible because it protects our way of life, and it is a life or death situation for our economy in that area. So I think it's really important that we have these conversations and that people understand how important it is to protect this industry.
Well, and it would be one thing if the forces that were driving people to where they had to make that kind of decision as to whether or not to move in order to get a better paying job somewhere else. It'd be one thing if those were market forces, if there was no more nickel in them, their hills, or whatever the case may be. Like that would be a legitimate reason for somebody to have to think about migration. But for the reason that you can't engage in productivity, you can't continue to pursue your happiness and make a living, is for some arbitrary political restriction that's been placed upon you by people who don't live there and don't have to deal with the consequences one way or the other. That's pretty absurd. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's part of the reason why it's going to be the most contentious issue during this congressional election cycle. Congressman Nolan was very supportive of the industry. He did everything he possibly could to support the industry because he knew it was a third of the economy in northeastern Minnesota. And he knew that those jobs pay for and help support all of the other areas of the economy,
right. Including
education and healthcare. And so it's really important that we have the ability to keep those jobs there because they're the ones that really hold the entire economy up. So it's tough to see them go, but it's going to be a very interesting debate to watch play out over the next many weeks and months.
And on the Republican side, County Commissioner Pete Stauber was already in the race. You hear rumors that former 8th Congressional District Republican candidate Stuart Mills might be re-entering. You hear a couple other interesting names too, which I don't know that it's appropriate to talk about right now. But are you satisfied that the debate is going to occur during the election in a way that will ultimately help educate Minnesotans as to the importance of your industry?
Well, that's my hope, but I know that with County Commissioner Stauber, he's a strong supporter of mining, and that's been his position all along. I think that the concern that we have, obviously, is if the Democratic candidate that emerges is not pro-mining, going to be a very tough fight. And as you've seen over these last couple of years, this congressional district has it's been a very close race every time. So this last round, I think it was 2,000 votes that separated Stuart Mills and Congressman Nolan. So it's becoming a more conservative area, and I think it's due in large part to the conversation related to mining. And it's a real detriment to the Democratic Party to have this as an issue area of debate, but we are seeing resolutions in every caucus across the region, both for and against mining. So it's a really strange time, and it's really unfortunate.
Kelsey Johnson, president of the Iron Mining Association of Minnesota, thanks for joining the program this morning.
Thank you both for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Safe travels.
Justice and Drew, I was just about to say the name of my show. Justice and Drew, my name is Walter Hudson. Brian McDaniel, we're both sitting in for Justice and Drew this morning. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. When we come back, we're going to get into the indictments of Russians coming out of the Mueller investigation and the nothing burger that it is. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Justice and